Hello and welcome back to the History of Video Games. My name is Ben and I'm here with the one and only Wes. How you doing today, Wes?
I am doing great. How you doing?
I'm doing pretty good. Feeling good. I just have like a lot of fun gaming things I want to talk to you about today. So I'm like totally ready. I feel like I've been prepping in my head about what I want to say, but I don't want to like throw myself into it too early, you know? So what have you been playing?
Okay.
Let's get that done first so I don't feel bad taking like a lot of time.
A little bit of an appetizer before the main meal, I guess. Yeah.
Sure.
So I mean, this is very unlike me. You and I are both very similar in we kind of bounce around between games. You are very dedicated to finishing them, me not always so much. But I've just been so much Palia and Baldur's Gate 3. And that's still what I've been doing. But thankfully, I have more stuff to talk about for Baldur's Gate 3 that I believe is interesting. And then I'll try to never talk about it again until I beat it.
Okay.
But what I wanted to talk about is two of my friends just purchased it. And you can play co-op, just like you could in Divinity Original Sin in Baldur's Gate 3. And the co-op play for this game is kind of insane. Like, it's a pretty big open world for all of the different zones that you can travel to in this game as you progress through the game. And it is totally uncoupled from other party members. I can go have a conversation with a main story character over here. My friend can at the exact same time have a conversation with a main story character over there. It's bonkers. And I feel like other games have done this, but just the seamlessness of how this works is blowing my mind. So you don't miss out on things. There is a little eavesdrop button that you can either have be mandatory so that anytime a party member talks to someone, you get brought over to that conversation and you can watch it happen. Or you can have it optional so that you can be doing your own thing. You see the little ear icon pop up and you click on it so then you can eavesdrop on their conversation. And it's just a really neat feature. They have something in there where as the person who's actually having the conversation is deciding on which dialogue option to choose, you can vote on which one you want them to choose. And it doesn't do anything, although I'm sure there could be some crazy Twitch integration stuff with that if there isn't already. But it's just fun to kind of watch those conversations together, have dialogue about how you want to do it, or, you know, if the person in your party is very much role-playing a specific kind of character, you can watch them make whatever decisions and see the fallout from it. The interesting thing about being able to wander on your own in a game that is meant to be a four-player party game is that you can get into battles and your friends can be nowhere to be seen. But they somehow made it so the world works seamlessly with, oh, my friend started a battle over here. He's in turn-based combat. I am not in combat, so I can walk around and do whatever I want. So they could just sit there in the turn-based combat and wait for you to catch up and hop into the battle once you roll initiative and all that. So it ends up working out pretty well. You can set it so that you can trade or access each other's inventories, which me and my friends trust each other enough to do that and have been enjoying kind of throwing gear each other's way. And yeah, it's just a lot of things that on paper I would think would make a game super difficult to code and have it actually work in this. And it just feels, again, I haven't played like real tabletop D&D that much, but it feels like I imagine the freedom of when you have two different quests going on without having to wait for the DM to have to run two different missions for two different people. So it's just a really fun experience. I'm looking forward to going through it more, and there's so much replayability in the game that I don't think playing with friends is going to inhibit me from wanting to play it a second time solo as well.
Okay, cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. Just more things to love about Baldur's Gate.
Exactly. Yeah. You know, I don't know if you've heard, but it's a good game.
I have heard.
But speaking of good games, I've been very curious because you've been talking to me about this game you've been playing, and it's a series that I've always wanted to take a look at. So why don't you talk about what you've been playing?
Yes, I have been playing Yakuza Kiwami, which is a remake of the first ever Yakuza game. And I've been playing this for like 3 weeks. It's been a long one. And remind me, Wes, have you played any of these games or you've just seen videos of them?
I've watched a couple people do playthroughs because they're wild games and they lend themselves to fun playthroughs, and I own one, but I've never played it.
Okay. Yeah, so I never played or really knew anything about these games other than they're like big, you know? There's like right, a series of like 7 or 8 games or something ridiculous. And I knew it was really, really good. So I just wanted to try it out. And I decided if I'm going to do it, I want to start at the beginning. So I picked up Yakuza Kiwami. And there's a lot I need to say about this one, Wes. A lot of mechanics, a lot of weird stuff. Let's start with the combat, because that's like what you're going to be doing most of the time, right? The combat kind of reminds me a little bit of like early Assassin's Creed combat or something. Like, it's definitely built for you versus multiple characters. Mm-hmm. And in general, it's all hand-to-hand fighting. I think it's like a little bit quicker and a little bit harder than other games I've played, like the Batman games or something. Like, the enemies telegraph their attacks, but it's not like they've got an exclamation point over their head when they're going to attack or something.
Right, right.
And some of them attack and move very quickly, almost giving me, what was that rabbit game we played? Was that Overgrowth?
Overgrowth, yeah.
Yeah, Overgrowth. Kind of giving me some of those vibes at times. But the main kind of gimmick of the combat is that you have 4 fighting styles. And one of these is kind of locked off for story-based reasons, so I mainly only use the other 3. But switching your style of combat, you do it with the D-pad and you get a completely different move set. And I ended up using these 3 combat styles a lot throughout the game and constantly was changing between them. I felt the game did an amazing job of really making each one feel useful in certain circumstances. So maybe one of the combat styles is really fast, so you can really dodge a lot of attacks easily, which when your opponent has like a knife or something that you can't really afford to keep taking damage from, you really just need to dodge them. And you want to be in that stance to easily dodge. But, you know, you're moving around so fast that you've given people all these light jabs, you don't do a whole lot of damage. But still, against like big boss characters with a weapon, you probably want to be in that stance. But then you've got another fighting style called like Beast Mode, where your character is like kind of wielding these giant arcing swings and stuff and can actually kind of do AoE attacks against large groups of enemies. So against large groups, that's a good one to be in. And then you have another style that's kind of a nice mix of a little bit of both of them for kind of the smaller group fight, which happens. That's probably the most common fight throughout the game. But I just felt like I was switching between them a lot. There were even sometimes a boss that you would verse that I think they purposefully wanted you to be in a certain style. Just the way that they attacked or how they choreographed their attacks or what weapon they had kind of lended you wanting to do the fight in a certain style. And if things weren't going well, I constantly was finding myself switching styles to see if a different one would work better. So I thought that whole system was great. I really liked it. That being said, there's some weird stuff about the combat too. For instance, I think a lot of the boss characters especially, they're like damage sponges, man. I mean, it takes sometimes like 10 minutes to do one fight. It takes forever. There's also like, I'm coming from Dark Souls, right? Which is the game I played before this. And Dark Souls has an amazing lock-on system that you have to use throughout the game. But this game has a lock-on system that like is barely functional and like does not work the majority of the time. Like I was constantly, my character would just kind of like start to like punch the wall because he was facing the wrong way and the lock-on just completely broke. And that is pretty frustrating at times, as you can imagine. I felt like even there were times when I was doing my own combo against the locked on enemy and the lock on would break because my combo had my guy spinning around doing like 360 flips and like, you know, I think the lock on just couldn't follow. So that was pretty annoying as well. But in general, I really enjoyed the combat. I should say, by the way, that this remake, I guess, used, I read that it's not the exact combat system as the original game. It's kind of like a more recent version of the game series is combat. So I don't know if the original game had this, but Kiwami had this. But kind of moving on to the story now, the story was really good. Tons of cutscenes, tons of characters that are likable. They have depth. They have great voice acting. everybody that you meet is kind of like relevant and has their own thing and own wants going on. And I just found myself kind of consumed by the story. I really enjoyed it. But it definitely got a little padded out towards the end. There are some missions where you're like, this isn't relevant. Like, why are we doing this? Or like somebody would show up and you're like, why are you here? Like, there's no reason for you to be here. They just needed a boss fight for like this chapter or something. And towards the end in particular, it got really like soap opera-y. And there was like, you know, this person you thought was dead was really not dead. Or like this person's like actually this other person's mother. And you're like, oh my God, just calm down, you know? It kind of started to kind of snowball out of control towards the end, I felt. I think having some curveballs in the story is good, but like there's a lot of curveballs in this. You know, it's like these triple agents and you're like, come on, this is like, we're getting a little too far.
Yeah.
But when I finished the story, I did, the ending's like, it's not the most satisfying ending, but I enjoyed it. And I really felt like, at least for this first one, that the ending was supposed to be like the end and not meant for like a sequel. You know, it kind of felt like it was all in one story. Like the story had an ending. So that was nice. And in general, I really liked the story. So I really enjoyed the game. I think it has some faults, you know, with the combat, with the story. The open world part I haven't mentioned, but basically in between story missions, there's this open world kind of that you run around in. It's pretty small because there's no like vehicle movement in it. So it has to be small because you're just walking. But it was okay. I felt like the open world wasn't super strong. I mean, you're playing like a Yakuza boss, pretty much. And the side quests are like, you know, kid comes up to you and wants to play hide and seek. And you're like,
yeah.
This isn't, you know, what are we doing? So that, you know, it's pretty weird. And I didn't, like some of the side quests I enjoyed a lot. And some of them I thought were just completely stupid and silly. There's also like weird mechanics. Like you've got this guy named Majima, who's like a rival, I guess. And he can just ambush you anywhere you are, any place you are on the map without any warning. Like you're just walking down the street and then he just jumps you. Cutscene, and then you're in the fight. And you can't run from any fight. So you have to face him. And towards the end of the game, he's like one of these damage shield bosses. And there were times when I was like, you know, I'll just do one more side quest and then I'm going to go to bed. And then a Majima fight happens and I'm like, oh my God, I have to fight this guy again.
15 minutes later.
Yeah, there were times I even just wanted to die. Like, I didn't want to fight him, and there's no real penalty for dying. So I was just like, yeah, just kill me, dude. I just don't want to do this. And that's probably not a good feeling when you're playing the game. So it definitely has its problems, but I thought overall it was very, very good. So I'm looking forward to playing the second one. I'm sure I'll pick it up at some point. But I would definitely recommend it if you've never played it, Wes. I think it's worth... I think I picked it up for $6. I mean, like, it's definitely worth that. So to me, it's like an 8 out of 10 game or something. It's like really good, has a couple flaws. So I really enjoyed it.
That's awesome. No, I'll definitely have to check it out. I'll probably do Yakuza 0 first, which is a prequel game, I think, that came out before Kiwami. But yeah, the just ridiculous like gifs and cutscenes that I've seen from this game, it's a world that I absolutely want to get into. So I'm glad to hear that it was a fun game to play.
Yeah, I have to say, like, the main story was not that comedic, really. It was kind of a more serious soap opera-ish kind of story or something.
Right.
Like something I'd see at an ER or something. I
think it's kind of the side content that gets a little
the side content is pretty
nuts.
Weird. That's definitely true. So, but yeah, it was a good time.
Cool.
But I think I'm good with it now. I think it said that my completion was only like 30% or something when I finished. But
right.
I think I'm good. I don't need to go back and get the achievement for getting like a like 5 blackjack hands straight or something.
Right,
like
exactly.
So many weird achievements and stuff. So
nice.
But yeah.
Cool.
The first Yakuza down.
All right. Well, we'll see. I mean, more of them go on sale. See if you want to continue some of the story, or I'm sure the older ones are a little bit rough now, but it's definitely, you know, it's a whole world. Like you said, there's like 8 games or something.
Yeah. I am curious to know what they do with the characters, because at the end of this first one, it felt pretty wrapped up, you know? So I'm definitely interested in that.
Yeah. Well, cool. That's awesome. I'm glad you had a good time with it. But now why don't we move on to our special topic for the day? We're going to be talking about a sort of new computer, a new variation on a computer, the TI-99/4A. And it was the A expansion on the TI-99/4 series of computers, I believe. So Ben, did you want to get us started out with this?
Oh yeah. There's not too much to say because the internals are like identical to the old computer for the most part. Like there's some small things, but you know, same CPU and everything, same RAM and everything. This one did come with a special keyboard, I guess, but the TI-99, as a quick reminder, had the first ever 16-bit microprocessor in it. And as a computer in general, the games have always looked really good, I thought. It has like the best sound that we've ever heard on a computer. And is really good. It's really one of my favorite computers, but there's not been a lot of games for it. And part of the reason for that is that it kind of came out as like a high-end PC. And when it originally came out in 79, it came out with a price of like over $1,000 in 1979 money, which is like over $4,500 for the PC in today's right. money. But this new computer, even though the internals are very similar and there's not really a lot that's changed, I think the thing that has changed is like their pricing model and what they're trying to accomplish with it, because the introductory price for the new one in 1981 is $525, which in today's money is just about $1,700. So it's like less than half the price. They really did a huge price cut on this. They eventually have this price war with Commodore. Maybe you can talk a little bit more about that. But the result of all these price cuts mean that the TI-99 becomes not something just for the rich people, but just for anybody. And like the original TI-99 up until now, I think the approximate units shipped have been about 20,000 units. But the new one, the TI-99/4A, is going to sell something like 2.8 million units over the course of 3 years. That is a huge difference. And I'm hoping that it results in a lot more TI-99 games for us. And with it being one of my favorite computers that we're seeing, I'm really excited about that. So
yeah,
I think more than anything, it's more of like a kind of a marketing change in terms of what Texas Instruments is doing and just the power of technology getting cheaper. That's really kind of in this new computer, but the actual specs haven't really changed that much. But I'm okay with that, you know. I want to see this succeed.
One thing that I will say has changed about the case is that they have kind of this external setup for peripherals that could be plugged into the system now, which they may have had on some form on the TI-99, but this is a separate version of it for this computer. And it could have things attached to it like voice synthesizers or, importantly for us, digital joysticks. So nice. We may seeing games on this more commonly now that could control with a joystick, which would be great. One of the issues, though, with all the peripherals that could be hooked up kind of like daisy chained in tandem onto each other is that if you put like 8 peripherals in, say like a couple different disk drives and something else, it could be like several feet long. I've seen a picture where it looks like it could like extend off a normal table. So they released another product along with this called the Peripheral Expansion Box, but it cost $1,400, which,
oh my God,
more expensive than the computer, I believe, when it came out. It did come with a disk drive and expanded memory, and actually ended up being fairly popular over its life. I think one was sold for every 10 TI-99/4A computers sold. So, yeah, and as Ben mentioned, the competitive pricing of this kind of ruffled some feathers over at Commodore because they had their VIC-20, which is probably before this one of the lowest cost like entry-level computers that's out there. And they ended up getting into a price war. Some point in the future, I believe it might be in 1983, the TI-99 is going to cut its price so low that it's selling at a loss for every computer it sells. So for now, this is great for the consumer, but in the long term, we'll have to see how it turns out for the companies.
Right. Yep. But yeah, I was just kind of taken back with how many units have shipped. Almost 3 million in 3 years. That's crazy. So I'm hoping this will be a kind of a big change for us because we don't see a lot of TI-99 games, or mostly all by Texas Instruments. So I'm hoping this gets some third parties in there, and hopefully they keep writing some awesome music bangers, because that's what the TI-99 is really good at, and I love it. So. All right, with that being said, though, Wes, let's head over into the timeline. We've got a really big game by Atari we got to talk about.
Hey everybody, how's it going? Welcome back. As Ben teased right before our little break, we've got a big game by Atari to talk about. You already know what it is. It's the title of this episode. It's Centipede. So let's get right into it. I got to take a look at it today. We didn't end up doing a dual review for this one, but man, I was very excited to take a look at this and very worried, as I am with most of these big game names, because I always hope I don't hate them.
Yeah,
but I'm happy to say I had a great time with Centipede. So let me talk a little bit about the background of the game first. It was developed for Atari by two programmers, Donna Bailey and Ed Log. Ed did most of the design and some of the programming, and Donna did a lot of the programming as well. And Ed Log, I believe, also designed Asteroids. I think one person, I believe it was a colleague, said about him in an interview, he always shows up. He's got probably the most home runs and the most strikeouts at the same time. So, you know, he's just always making these games, and he's definitely landed on a couple big ones with Asteroids and Centipede. Donna, it's interesting to note, is one of the few female programmers at the time, and she had actually discovered video games after hearing the song Space Invader by The Pretenders, which I believe came out in 1979, and she's coding in assembly language in 1981. So that's pretty awesome that after learning about video games in a couple of years, she's working on what's going to become a huge video game. Like several of the big hits we've seen recently, the designers mentioned that they wanted to try to make it a game that didn't just appeal to a male audience. A lot of the shooting games at the time, people viewed as only being interesting for men. And so this, they wanted to make it more about these insects and fighting these insects while still in a Space Invaders kind of style, to hopefully be able to attract both men and women to play this game. And something worked, obviously, as we know, because this game is very popular. An interesting little Easter egg of sorts, hidden in the code for the game, there was the Morse code for copyright 1980 Atari, and apparently it was put in place as a way to warn people attempting to bootleg the game and also to try and catch people bootlegging the game. And it was apparently used as evidence in at least one court case for someone who tried to bootleg Centipede. Also buried in the game's information is an unused grasshopper sprite that would have played the role of the spider that ended up being in the game. The cabinet itself looks awesome. It's iconic. If you've ever Googled or seen a Centipede's cabinet, you know exactly what that classic Centipede looks like. On the side of the cabinet, along with the colorful mushrooms and the iconic Centipede text on the marquee. And I never noticed before, but you know, in the game, the centipede is kind of ducking and weaving between these mushrooms. And on the marquee, there's these gigantic mushrooms that it's snaking in between. Love that detail. Never noticed it until looking at this. And of course, this game is going to show up in many, many movies, so it is very relevant in that sense. Moving on to gameplay, I think most people know in general how you play Centipede, but I think I'm going to go over the basics just to give you a little bit of detail. The core gameplay is really kind of similar to Space Invaders. As I mentioned, you have stuff coming from the top of the screen that you have to shoot from the bottom of the screen, and you can only have one shot on screen at a time. Where it differs, though, is how the centipede moves and kind of ducks down another level if it hits a mushroom in its path. Also, the fact that the centipede is made up of multiple segments and it splits when it gets shot in its center into two separately moving centipedes. There are also obstacles like fleas that fall from the sky and drop mushrooms on the screen, and that can be destroyed to give you more time to kill the centipede. After killing all the different parts of the centipede, you can progress to the next round, where I believe everything just gets a little bit hectic and faster. More spiders show up on the screen. When the spiders are on the screen, they kind of bounce diagonally near you, and you get more points the closer they are when you kill them. There's also a sort of bonus UFO kind of analog with a scorpion that goes horizontally across the screen and gives you a lot of points if it's hit. And the game originally controlled with a trackball, which I didn't realize before covering this. And unlike Space Invaders, you can actually move a little bit up from the bottom of the screen. So if a centipede makes it all the way to the bottom of the screen, you're not totally screwed. You can actually dodge it. Eventually will hit a wall and then work its way back up to the screen so you can shoot it down. So with that overview of the gameplay of Centipede, let me talk about my ratings for this game. For graphics, I gave it a 4 out of 10. It's strange because when I kind of break down all the different components of the visuals, it sounds like the game doesn't have great graphics, but there's just a certain quality to them that I really enjoy. The background, despite being all black, is dotted with multicolored sprites, and the colors look really vibrant. I think Donna mentioned specifically that she wanted to go for pastel colors because she thought they would really grab people's attention. The color palette also changes every time you kill a centipede and go to a new stage, which is really cool. And that affects everything on the screen, from the centipede to the mushrooms to the spiders. The spider enemy honestly just looks okay, but it does have, I think, 3 different colors in it, which I really appreciate. And the mushrooms, I really liked more than I thought I would. They're still just 2 colors, but they have some charm to them from the fact that they're not just random blocks in the way of the centipede. The centipede also looks great. There isn't a ton of detail on it, but the head of the centipede has blue eyes, and each time you break off a section and it becomes a new centipede, the head on that section gets eyes too. So I love that little detail, so you always know where the head of the centipede is. And I, of course, love the little circular feet that kind of go back and forth as the centipede's moving along. It's like, I want to say, a 3-frame animation or something. It actually looks pretty good, the way that these little tiny legs move back and forth. Your ship, which I believe is called the Bug Blaster, compared to all the rest of the stuff on screen, just looks all right. But I really like the speed of the lasers when you're firing up close, and the death animation is actually surprisingly nice, a really colorful explosion, although it is kind of small. Moving on now to sounds. Every sound in Centipede is pretty simple, but they all add up to make this really nice and not annoying wall of noise. I guess that's a little bit of an oxymoron to say a nice sounding wall of noise, but the shooting noise is great and spacey sounding. The centipede has this sort of steady march sound as it moves that I really like, and that replaces sort of the 4-note sequence thing that we get from Space Invaders. The spider makes some weird beepy noises, and the fleas make the classic kind of dive bomb sort of noise as they fall down. So all of the individual elements feel like stuff that we've heard before, but when it's all playing at once, I felt like it really worked together, and it wasn't overwhelming at all. So I ended up giving it a 3.25 out of 10, despite the fact that, as far as I know, it doesn't have any music in it. Moving on now to gameplay, I gave it a 4 out of 10 here. I mean, it still has that Space Invaders heart, so I'm not going to say this is my favorite arcade game of all time, but it is absolutely fun, and it definitely has that one more play feeling. There is enough stuff on screen that shooting feels fairly fast, even though you only have one shot on screen at a time, and the game feels very responsive. You get these great moments when you're firing super fast at something really close to you. The centipede can kind of get caught in like a vertical downward path, and if you just spam, you get the whole centipede in one go, and it's very satisfying. You can also hold down the fire button in this game, which is a nice change, instead of having to repeatedly tap it. And I like that you can destroy the mushrooms on screen to alter the centipede's path as it goes. It always keeps the game interesting with all these different mushrooms popping up because you never know exactly where the centipede is going to go and how it's going to descend. So it keeps you guessing, keeps you on your toes. And there are also a lot of fun ways to get extra points in the games that I enjoyed, like waiting until the last minute to shoot the spider to get the most points. I also found out from watching videos that if you clear the bottom of the screen of mushrooms, fleas drop down to spawn more, and you get more points for killing the fleas. So there's lots of different techniques you can use to really rack up a high score. And the gameplay just feels very fluid and much more fast-paced than Space Invaders, so I really had a good time with it. Moving on now to relevance, I gave this a 9 out of 10. I think it's almost as relevant as Frogger. I mean, it may not influence a new genre or anything, but we're definitely going to see a lot of clones of this and sequels, and it is obviously hugely relevant in video game pop culture, up there with Pac-Man, Donkey Kong, Frogger, and all those. When you get down to it, it is just sort of a variation on Space Invaders, but it's still very original, definitely has its own identity, and keeps the gameplay fresh and interesting. So overall, that left me with a 3.75 out of 10 for Centipede. Maybe a little bit low because the sounds weren't as good as I hoped they would be, but it is still a super solid game that is obviously going to be incredibly popular, and thankfully, it lives up to the hype. I had a great time with it. I can see why it is so well-loved, with its vibrant colors, fast responsive gameplay, and fun theming and engaging sounds.
Nice. Cool.
Yeah. Again, you know, I'm always very happy when I play one of these and I can say, okay, I get it. You know?
Yeah.
There's still an element of it that feels a little bit simplistic Space Invaders to me, but the gameplay being so fluid, the colors being so fun, I can really see what was so appealing about it.
Yeah, and I didn't know about the trackball. I feel like that's definitely a big bonus.
Yes.
I think that'd be a lot of fun.
Yeah, and since you could actually move up and down the screen a little bit as well, it seems like it would be a really good control scheme for it.
Yeah, you can definitely juke the centipede.
For sure.
That's cool.
Yeah, so that is Centipede, a great one.
Mm-hmm. There were a lot of clones for it, Wes. Maybe not like a crazy amount, but we have quite a few here. We've got one called Magic Worm by Saddam. We've got Mill Pack by Valadon Automation. Valadon Automation, I'll say. We've got Magic Maggot by Videotron. Magic Maggot by Digimatic Italia. And Caterpillar by Olympia. All right, but with that being said, Wes, we have to save some arcade games for next week's episode, so we're going to move into some computer games and go into the first one that I did for today. I think last week we did a game called Mars by Arctic that you covered,
right.
And this is another Mars game. This one's called Caverns of Mars by Greg Christensen, published through APX, the Atari Users Program. And this one's a pretty important one in terms of gaming history. It sold really well to the point where Atari not only kind of like got the rights to it and published it themselves, but they actually ported the game to the Atari 2600 in 83. So this is crazy because the creator of this game was like a college freshman at the time. And within a year, I guess it's been reported that he was getting royalty checks of something like $100,000 or something.
Holy cow.
So I think he still continued to be a programmer, but he didn't publish many other games under just himself. I think, I don't know, I've seen online that he actually worked for a company called Interplay, which we're going to talk about a little bit later.
Right.
But maybe it's just a different guy with the same name. I don't know. I feel like he would have been like senior game designer or something, but it was just like he was just like under programmer as credits, and I'm like, I don't know. So maybe it's the same guy, maybe it's not. But I just find it fascinating that this Atari Users Program, which we've done a special topic about previously, just kind of created these like hit stars out of no name recognition people that just sent a game into Atari, and then all of a sudden it was being played by millions of people. So it's super cool. And Caverns of Mars, the main idea behind the game is scramble, like definitely scramble, but vertical. So instead of going left to right, you're going top to bottom, and you're still in this one, you're shooting down the whole time. There's no shooting sideways or shooting up, and the mechanics of Scramble are still here. So a big part of it is collecting fuel that's on the ground. As you can imagine, you're falling kind of like down through a tunnel. So there's a vertical, you know, top to bottom that you're falling through. And the tunnel will kind of go from side to side. So you're kind of turning and weaving your way through these tunnels. And at the ground on the tunnels is where the fuel will be that you have to shoot, as well as enemies. In general, the game has a couple different phases. The first phase is there's a little cutscene of you at the top of Mars, and then you go down into a hole. And the first phase is you going through these tunnels, shooting down at the ground with your gunship. The gunship, it kind of looks like a letter N, maybe, like a lowercase letter N, and or like a X-Fighter or something from a top-down view. Basically, you've got these two wings on the ship, and when you fire, you actually fire a bullet from each of the two wings. So it's not in the center of your body, which is always like a little concerning. But you do fire two shots at a time. You can only have one set of two shots on the screen at any time. But if you kind of hover close to the ground, you can definitely get a lot of shots off. And the first wave, or the first phase, has you going through these tunnels, just kind of collecting fuel, making sure you don't run into the walls or the ceiling, which is like the hardest part. And there's some enemies, but there's not a whole lot of enemies attacking you in the first phase. They're just kind of there to kind of be in the way. But after you get through the first phase, you go to phase two, and phase two is a lot harder. It's the only phase that I think is genuinely kind of hard. And on that one, the whole screen kind of clears and you're at the top, and ships will fly up from the bottom and try to just ram you. Like, there's just a lot of them. And some of them are slightly bigger and actually have a big letter F on them, and they're fuel ships, where if you hit them, you'll regain fuel again. But it's kind of like just tons of enemies flying up at the top, just trying to ram you, and you're just kind of shooting down a few of them to make a path and doing a lot of dodging. But that one's a lot more fast-paced and is harder. Then when you get to phase three is not really a phase, it's more like a cutscene where your ship goes down this narrow hole in the ground, and it slowly gets narrower and narrower, and you just have to make sure you don't touch the sides of the screen or else you explode. But it's very easy just to stay in the center of the screen, and then when the hole's at its narrowest point, your ship will go down, eventually land on like an egg or something. I don't really know what it's supposed to be. But you set a bomb in the middle of this structure. And then the last phase is that you have to escape back the way you came. When you do this part, it kind of skips like phase two, where all the ships are flying at you, and just goes to the tunnels of phase one. But you're going the opposite direction. And there's no enemies in this part. It's just purely a dodging survival thing, trying to get out before the timer goes off. And it's kind of set so that if you don't run into any of the walls, you will get out in time. So it's kind of a slightly trivial thing, assuming you just do the dodging right. But once you're out, you know, it says Mars has exploded or something, and then you go again. And the whole thing resets.
On to Mars number two.
Yeah. And that's the game. And there's some things I really like about the game. I mean, for one, you have like kind of a story of what you're doing from beginning to end, from entering this Mars base and destroying stuff to placing a bomb and then getting out. That felt really good. You know, it felt like this is a kind of a full loop here, which I enjoyed. The whole dodging of stuff, which is like most of the stages, felt really nice. The game is really responsive, plays at a very high frame rate. For this time period, it's got to be playing at like 30 frames a second or something. Like, it feels really nice to play. And the collecting of fuel in the first phase felt really nice. In the second phase, there's so many things flying at you. It felt very random, and I often died from not having enough fuel by the time I got to the third phase. But luckily, if you die, it starts you at the beginning of that phase. So I kind of started me after the hard part, so it was totally fine. And yes, yeah, it's just kind of a nice game loop. The destruction of shooting the ships is cool. There's only like really one model of ship besides the fuel ship, and I don't think any ships actually shoot at you, but it was fine. It got the point across, and I enjoyed it. Some of the things I didn't like about the game, and this is kind of the real sticking point, is that after you go through these four phases and you're ready to redo the whole thing again, it replays the phases exactly as they were again. The difficulty doesn't go up. And I've checked multiple videos in my own attempt, and it doesn't change. Like, the spawning patterns are the same. It's not randomized in any way. So, like, when I played it, I was able to beat it on my first try. Like, maybe I don't know what difficulty it. I think you can pick your difficulty in the beginning. Maybe I was on the easy or medium or something, but I played it, and I beat it on the first try, and then I was like, I guess that's it. You know, like, that's everything. Unless I manually change my difficulty, it just is the same thing again. So, I don't know. I felt like the amount of game inside the game is only like 3 minutes long, you know? I just really wish there was some sort of randomization to it, because this game would have really benefited from that. And it's kind of a perfect game to do so. I mean, you're flying through tunnels, just make them go sometimes to the left, sometimes to the right. We see that with like racing games. I don't think where the racing game kind of turns to the left and right randomly. I mean, I don't think it's too hard for them to be able to do that, but they just couldn't do it, I guess. So I think that's really the sticking point behind the game. The replayability is just not quite there. But with that being said, let me get into my scores. I'll start with the gameplay. I mean, I pretty much said everything I wanted to say already. I gave the gameplay a 3 out of 10 for Caverns of Mars because I did enjoy the game when I was playing it. It was just I wanted more game, and there wasn't really much to do afterwards. Being able to manually change the difficulty between your runs is cool. But like when you're doing a run and you finish the four phases, it should get harder, even in the same run, because otherwise you're just doing the same thing over and over and over again. And I don't think that's super fun. So I just wish it was somewhat dynamic, but I did enjoy what was there. For graphics, I gave that a 2.75 out of 10. We do have a lot of multicolored sprites, although your ship is not one of them. Your ship, it looks pretty unique. It kind of looks like a claw or something. I like the look and design of the ship. I like that it fires two missiles, although it's harder to control. It's kind of unique and something a little bit different. The enemy ships look like genuine rocket ships. They look good. And all the fuel canisters and stuff look really nice. A lot of the sprites have a flashing kind of effect to them that I really enjoyed. It kind of just makes them pop and makes it feel like, you know, there's like an alarm siren going off or like you're invading and everybody's like on alert. I don't know. I really enjoyed that, how flashy all the ships and some of the effects and props were. And then the tunnels themselves looked really good. There's a section when you get down into that like egg thing where the whole screen is like flashing and there's some bricks, and I wish the egg looked like something actually like visual that exists, but it was fine. But yeah, I thought the tunnels were good. They're kind of like the whole game has this red background with a blue outline on the edges and then a black center screen where you're actually flying around in. So I thought everything looked quite nice on the Atari 8-bit here. For sound, I gave it a 2.75 out of 10. There's no real like music in the game, but there are a lot of kind of cool original sound effects, especially when the little cutscenes play out, like when you're placing the bomb and when you exit out of the top, you know, when Mars explodes. And there's some nice sound effects during that. When the game starts, it kind of starts with like a theremin sound. If you know what that is, it's kind of a spooky sound, but I really like it. Super unique. And in general, I thought, you know, everything that I wanted to have sounds had sounds. They all sounded really good, very spacey. A lot of them had a little bit of bass to them. So I just thought the sounds were well done, but nothing special either. So give it 2.75 for that reason. For relevance, I decided to go 7.5 out of 10 for this guy, just because, you know, it gets ported around, it sells very well. It's scrambled but vertical, which we've never seen before, and I think we'll definitely see a lot more in the future. So it just has a lot of kind of cool legacy behind it, I think, and it's something a lot of people are going to see. So I wanted to give it some points. And overall, I gave it a 2.75 out of 10. I'd say this game is very, very good. Like, I really wanted to get it to that 3 out of 10 territory, and I just couldn't because I just felt the game wasn't fun to replay. You know, it's kind of like fun until you beat the stage at that difficulty, and then you're like, okay, that's it, you know?
Yeah.
It's like, do I want to do it again? That's, and I would say kind of no. So, and, you know, there's four phases, but like one of the phases doing the first phase backwards, and the third phase is essentially a cutscene that you can possibly die if you run into the wall like an idiot. So there's not a whole lot of variety to it. Like, there's really only two phases that felt like genuine phases. And one of them, the first phase, I think is very easy. So, yeah, I think it's really good. I really liked what I played, but there just wasn't enough variety to really get it to that 3 out of 10 for me.
Yeah. Interesting. Yeah, I mean, definitely looking at visuals of it, it does have a cool style and, yeah, cool design. But if it's only good for one playthrough, not great. But obviously people liked it, you know, so.
True.
Greg did something right.
True.
Very cool. Well, let's move on then with some honorable mentions that we have here. Sticking with the computer games, we have one called Crush, Crumble, and Chomp by Epix. Came out for Atari 8-bit, Apple II, and TRS-80. And we really wanted to take a look at this one because it was a game where you play as one of several monsters destroying different cities. Sounds pretty cool. But the graphics were just all right, and the game ran super duper slow, so we knew that we wouldn't have given it a very good review.
And the next one here we've got is Forgotten Island by Mark Russell Benioff and Crystalware. It was a game similar to Fantasyland 2041 AD, which is another kind of graphical text adventure game with an escape from an island type theme. It came out sometime in 1981, and Benioff, who created this game, would later go on to buy Times Magazine and is now a billionaire. So that's worked out for him.
Yeah, this game may not have kickstarted it, but he was doing something right. All right, so then we also have one here called Kamikaze by Stargazer, and it is a pretty nice scramble type game on the Atari 8-bit that looked pretty good and ran well.
I'm sorry, I have to go off on a tangent for SideQuest because this just got me thinking, you know, everybody, I feel like if I was playing video games, you know, when I was younger, my dad would be like, you know, what are you doing with your life? And then this guy's a billionaire. And I just saw Elon Musk was streaming Diablo 4 on Twitter. And he was a level 100, which means he had to put hours into the game.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Like, I mean, he's a well-known gamer, I feel like. So, hey, you know, we just sit here and play games all day. Eventually, the money's going to fall into our lap.
Yeah, yeah, surely.
There's a correlation, you know.
Yeah. All right, but moving on to this next one, we've got Cosmic Cosmades. That's a hard name to say, by Derek Hipkin. It's a Space Invaders clone that actually ran very fast and had a boss fight and had good sound effects on the Commodore PET, which is a computer that doesn't have a lot of those things happening most of the time. Came out sometime in 1981. And then we've got a game called Dark Forest by Sirius Software. Seems like a combination of Risk with a collect the treasures type of game. Imagine Risk. But your main goal is to like get to three different territories on the map and not necessarily control the whole map or something. So it's a take on Risk, but the visuals seemed quite good, very colorful on the Apple II in 1981.
All right, next let's move on to the second game that I got to cover today. Again, this came out sometime in 1981. We are still currently in June, but we have a couple here that we just figured seemed like June games to us. But this one is called Demon's Forge, and it is by Brian Fargo and published by Saber Software. And we mainly wanted to bring this up because it is the first game widely released by Brian Fargo, who I wasn't familiar with the name at first, but he is a game developer and producer who is going to found Interplay Entertainment, which Ben mentioned earlier with Greg Christensen, may or may not be the same person. And also, he's going to go on to produce games like the original Fallout and the Wasteland series of games, and eventually also found the company In Exile Entertainment, which is still making games today. So This guy is pretty big in the industry, and this is the first game that was actually released to a bunch of people, so we wanted to talk about that. He originally self-published this game. I believe Saber Software was actually just kind of his company that he made so that he could publish this game. And he apparently marketed it by putting an ad in Soft Talk magazine and then calling retailers and saying, "Hey, do you have Demon's Forge? It looks great. I saw it in Soft Talk magazine." They would say, "No, we don't have it. We'll look into it." And then he would get a call for somebody wanting to order a copy of it.
Nice.
I don't know how true that is, but that's a hilarious way of getting your name out there and your game into stores. And I think, you know, it didn't end up being hugely popular, but I'm sure a few people played it. In 2011, In Exile Entertainment actually released a game called Hunted: The Demon's Forge. Very similar name, and it did have a somewhat similar fantasy setting, but that's about it. The stories aren't very different at all. That one had a lot more story than this game, of course, but it must have been an homage or something if Fargo was involved. In this Demon's Forge, though, you're sent to a labyrinth as punishment for fighting with the king's guards, I think. Instead of being executed, you served the king for a while, so he's like, "I won't kill you, you can just go to the labyrinth that nobody escapes from."
Classic.
Know, pretty good deal, yeah. And the demon part of this Demon's Forge comes from the fact that there is a demon lurking somewhere in the labyrinth who, hint hint, might be the boss that you have to fight at the end of this. The Demon's Forge is a graphic text adventure with classic adventure gameplay, text adventure style, like puzzle solving kind of gameplay. Unfortunately, complete with hyper-specific verb usage. That is definitely something going on in this game that I wasn't a huge fan of. On the plus side, it doesn't seem like you have a carry limit, or at least I didn't find it for all the items I was picking up. But on the negatives, again, there is one puzzle at the beginning of the game that if you don't solve it while you're in the room, the game becomes unwinnable, and the game doesn't tell you that it's no longer winnable. So I didn't get very far in my playthrough, but I was able to read through somebody else's playthrough of this game. Basically, you get this message when you walk into a room that says a skinny man is running through the room. And you have to type "follow skinny man" to find the room where he's in. Otherwise, that room isn't accessible anymore. So that's a kind of a big yikes on the specific verbs for a text adventure game. Basically, it controls like you'd think. You know, you have to find stuff. Because it's a graphic text adventure, you kind of see elements in the world and you know, oh, there's a chest there. I can type "open chest." And then you have puzzles to solve to progress through this game. So with that, let me move on to my ratings for this game. For graphics, I gave it a 2.5 out of 10. There's an original version of this game and also a version that was published in 1983. And I believe the 83 version does have slightly better graphics. On the classic Apple II version, there are bright colors and there's some of that dithering that we've talked about that gives the illusion of more colors, so it looks pretty decent. There's interactable elements on screen that are pretty easy to spot in all of the rooms, and it does seem like items change or disappear when you interact with them. For example, there's a section where a hole gets burned in the carpet, and after that happens, there's a big black spot on the carpet, so it does evolve in a way that I really like when graphic text adventures do. There are also a fair number of different visuals in this game, from caves that look pretty good, underground gardens, and then all the way to a killer rabbit and a demon king. So there's a lot of variety in this game, really fun. It still does have that sort of kids drawing kind of look that the online software graphic text adventures have as well, but it's much better than just a normal text adventure in my opinion. I love having a visual element and it looks pretty good. Moving on to sounds, I gave it a 0 out of 10 here. We have seen some of these with sounds, but as far as I could tell, there weren't any in this game. And on to gameplay, I gave this a 2 out of 10. Unfortunately, it seems like this game does have a lot of instant kill scenarios, which I know is kind of the way that these games operated because they wanted you to have to play it many times. But playing it today just doesn't feel great with that type of gameplay. And as I mentioned, there's very specific verb usage. In one instance, the Blue Ranga blog mentioned that he had to use "look" to find something in a costume. but then couldn't use look to search a body, had to use search instead. And search didn't look when he was looking for the thing inside the costume. So there's not much consistency, I guess, or redundancy in what verbs can be used for similar actions. So that can be pretty frustrating in this type of game. I will say, though, I really enjoyed the fantasy mishmash kind of setting. It reminds me of, I forget exactly what it was called, but where you're the detective and you go to investigate this murder and you end up fighting a demon with a magical sword. You know, it's got fun stuff going on in it. And the visuals help give you hints as to what's interactable in the world. And that just kind of made the process a lot more fun for me. But still, it wasn't my favorite text adventure to play through. For relevance, I only gave this a 5 out of 10. I mean, it's hard to say because the game itself, I don't feel like is relevant. This isn't necessarily the one that's going to get Brian Fargo known. But it's not as if this is totally unrelevant. I mean, it is his first game and he is going to be big in the industry. So I think all of the relevance for this game is basically the fact that Brian Fargo made it and that it's his first widely published game. It's fairly similar to other graphic text adventures we've seen, and it doesn't really make any significant changes that I could see, but it is his first game, so we definitely wanted to take a look at it. And so overall, that left me with a 1.75 out of 10. Unfortunately, Demon's Forge is just an okay text adventure, but it has some nice colors and visuals, along with some unique puzzles, and in some cases, they were just a little too strange to kind of for me to figure out how to solve. But I'm really excited to see where Brian Fargo's path goes from here. I mean, if we know that at some point in the path, it's going to lead to Fallout, the original Fallout, I'm super excited. So even if this one wasn't my favorite of all time, I know there's some good things to come.
Oh, yeah. And it's super interesting to me. I didn't know anything about this guy before, but like how much his hands have been in other great game studios and great games is kind of crazy.
Yeah.
Like, sure, he made some games, you know, and he formed this company, but eventually Interplay Studios, which is where he's going to end up for a long time, becomes a publisher. And his main role was to find small studios that they can grab their games from and publish. And the studios that he found and had a part in playing into their destinies includes Blizzard at the very beginning. They weren't known as Blizzard at the time. They were known as Silicon and Synapse, Parallax. I don't know if you know that company, Wes. I don't think they're around anymore, but they definitely made some great games. BioWare, Baldur's Gate, which was actually through a company called Black Isle, which was a subdivision of Interplay Studios. Planescape Torment. I mean, just so many.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's kind of crazy because I had never heard of this guy and he really made a big impact on the history of video games. So I'm glad we were able to cover one of his first big games.
For sure.
And I'm excited to see what he does next. And especially when he makes some of those very recognizable games, the fact that he's still making games now is kind of crazy.
Yeah. And I should have mentioned, I'm pretty sure when he made this game, he was either in high school or had just graduated high school, you know, so.
Yeah.
This isn't a reflection of what the quality of the games will be going forward, but it's, hey, getting practice, learning games, and taking steps forward, so I can totally respect that.
Yeah. And if you want to play their newest game, his latest one's going to come out called Clockwork Revolution. That's kind of crazy. I looked at that this summer. I feel like we mentioned it on the podcast about stuff we were looking forward to, and I was like, yeah, there's a game called Clockwork Revolution. Looks good. It's his company. That's kind of crazy. I'm just blown away. So, yeah. With that being said, though, we've got some more games to check out for today. One of the biggest games of the year, actually, is this next one, but it's not something that we're going to like. So, we didn't end up reviewing it, but it's called Empire of the Overmind, also known as just Overmind sometimes by Microcomputer Games. And it's just a non-graphic text adventure, like Zork or something. But it's generally regarded as one of the best of its era. It does away with the common north, east, west, south movement for world locations. And instead, you have to type in stuff like take road or climb cliff or something to move from location to location, which makes mapping much harder because it's not like grid-based necessarily. And you can end up kind of traversing all over, and the distances can be very different. So it makes mapping much, much harder. But it also features many puzzles that have different solutions to the same puzzle, which is very rare for this time period. So it's very highly regarded by people. And definitely have to mention it. But yeah, with no graphics, it's not going to go well for us.
Yeah. And then we have a game called Goblins by Highlands Computer Services, which is a graphic text adventure in a wireframe sort of style. It had some decent graphics and some animations even, but a poor parser for its puzzles and a collect the treasures theming. So not something we really wanted to play. And we also have one called Operation Apocalypse by Strategic Simulations, which was a hex-based strategy game by the same dev who made Computer Conflict. And it's a similar type of game, but it had more mechanics to it, like paratroopers.
So it was more confusing.
Yeah, basically.
Yeah. All right, well, this next one is fairly confusing as well, Wes. And it's the second one that I reviewed for today. It's called Galactic Saga 4, Tawala's Redoubt.
Oh man, there's a fourth one.
Yeah, I didn't think there'd be a fourth one. I don't know why they made a fourth one, but we have covered, I think, every single one in this series, so we might as well continue, Wes. To be fair, every game in the series has been a completely different game.
Yeah.
Held together just by lore, pretty much. And this is no different. This game, I wasn't able to play it very well, because the game is meant to be played over the course of several hours, so things go pretty slowly and are not always very intuitive of how to do things. There is a, I think like a 40-page manual for it.
Oh boy.
But a fair amount of that is lore, to be fair. But I'll do the best I can to describe it. I think I have a pretty good concept of what it is. So in this game, the lore is like in the end of the trilogy, you like banish an enemy, you know, whatever. And from the galaxy, they were like controlling the galaxy. And now the enemy has landed on like a planet on like the outer rim, if you will. And it's just like, well, if I can't take over the galaxy, I'll just take over this little planet. And you lead the rebellion against him. So that's how it's related in the lore. But you don't play as the main character of all the three games of the trilogy, which I forget his name, but it was something kind of crazy. But you play as a different character. And the game, I think the best way to describe it is kind of more of a game of like kind of spying, diplomacy, and taking your time. It's more a game about information, I guess. I think the main concept is that, you know, you have a little rebellion, and before you can attack the main enemy, who has a force much larger than you, you need to build your forces. The manual specifically mentions that there's like a general who's out on the map somewhere that you have to find. And when you find him, his army will join yours, which will be a very massive boost to your army. And it also mentions that there is a cache of weapons somewhere hidden on the map that you have to find to, again, make your army very strong. So my kind of read of the situation is you can't really attack the enemy base until you have found these two things. The enemy itself, though, will occasionally randomly leave their base and run around the map a bit. And so you send out spies to get information about what the enemy army is doing and keep tabs on them so that your army doesn't accidentally collide with theirs, causing a game over. The combat itself, I don't think the game's really meant to be much of a combat game. It's more of a you win, you lose, that's it kind of game.
Right.
But you can do things like pillage villages and stuff and loot and burn down neutral towns and attack them. So I'm not really sure what happens when you do that. I tried to do it, but the game has a real-time element to it with a clock ticking in the background, and it'll say, like, it will take 7 days to travel to this town, and it takes a long time. You can speed up the clock, which I tried to do, but it still felt like it took a while. But, that's the general part of the game. I think it's more just like kind of spying on the enemy, trying to not be where they are, while at the same time looking for resources from the world. You can ask villages for help with the situation and try to get them on your side. You can give them gifts and stuff. So I think there's a large kind of diplomacy aspect along with this kind of hiding and informational part of the game. So that's kind of what the game's about. Let me get into my ratings. I'll talk a little bit about it some more. Starting with the gameplay, I ended up giving it a 2.25 out of 10. I think it's all right, but it feels very slow. Like I just was trying to play the game and just felt like I played for 15 minutes and like nothing happened.
Oh no.
The enemy never left their base. I sent out messengers and they didn't come back yet. I sent out spies. They didn't come back yet. I don't know. It just felt like nothing was really happening. Like you can go and look on the map and kind of see the symbols move around, but it just takes so long. And, you know, it takes some time to get acquainted with all the things you can do as well. I think one of my favorite parts about the game, and one of the most interesting parts about the game, is the fact that you can speed up time, which I don't think we've really seen at all in the history of video games. And that's obviously something that's going to be huge later in stuff from, like, SimCity to The Sims to all sorts of games that have time as a core mechanic to them.
Right.
So I liked that mechanic, although I don't think it worked super well in this. It felt felt like it was still too slow, even at fast settings. But and it did say in the manual, you know, this is something that's going to take a couple hours. So it's supposed to be a big strategy kind of game. So I'm not too surprised, but yeah, it just was very slow. And because it's very slow, you know, the graphics and stuff in it are good as well. I ended up giving the graphics a 2.75 out of 10, but there's no like motion to the graphics. I think that's the worst part about it. Like there's a map of the world and you do see the little stick figures kind of move on it a little bit, but for the most part it's very static. And then you have a camp as well, which you kind of are at when you're giving orders. And that's really well detailed, beautiful kind of landscape in the background, super colorful on the Apple II, but it's very static as well. Like there's some kind of, we'll say, cutscenes, or there's a stick figure that runs in when they're like delivering a message or something, but that's kind of, it doesn't happen that often, so it just felt very static. And the fact that there's no like real combat in the game, you know, just kind of hurts that even more. For sound, there was some sounds in this game, very beepy. It wasn't very good. It was just some sounds that kind of told you that like the things you were doing were actually going through, pretty much, you know, the commands were actually being submitted, and then you get some beeps and that's pretty much it. So I just gave it a 1.75 out of 10 for sound, because there were some sounds and they were even a little varied at times, you know, but they were all still beeps. So not too much going on there. For relevance, I did give it a 6.75 out of 10, just because it's the last of the Galactic Saga. There is not a fifth one. this is the end. And I liked the interesting concept regarding the time and being able to fast forward that. It was cool, even if it was still slow. Overall, I gave it a 2.25 out of 10. It's all right. I kind of like the concept, but you know, I feel like a game like this, a kind of complicated strategy game, with this kind of scope, we're just not there in terms of graphics or UI design or being able to issue commands or have things look correctly. You know, I think it's kind of punching over its weight and it shows, you know. So, and that's not a problem specific to this game. I think a lot of these strategy games coming out in 1981 have this problem of being overly complicated and the computer part is just not quite there yet.
Yeah,
but like I would love to see a game like this made today. I think it could be very cool, but in 1981, it just was not a good game yet. So, but it was a cool idea. You know, I'm glad that they made it.
Yeah, I mean, interesting way to take the series for sure. To have you no longer be the main character, and they're like, "Well, where do we go after we're dealing with galactic level consequences? Just make it very, very tiny." And the bad guy's still out there. It's exactly. Funny. Yeah, I could see it being pretty interesting.
And you know what's funny too is because you're like on a planet and it's not galactic anymore, the setting felt very fantasy compared to previously it was all space themed.
Right.
I feel like, you know, you're like in a tent I don't know. It didn't feel spacey, but it was still cool. It looked cool. And I want to say, by the way, I don't know if I mentioned, but this was by Broderbund, who made all the other ones as well. And a fairly big company for computer games at the time. So, yeah. The Last of the Galactic Saga. And it was a pretty interesting saga.
Yeah. The story alone was... the pages and pages in the manual were always very interesting.
Yep.
All right. Well, let's move on now to our last couple of honorable mentions for the day. We are going to be talking about some handheld games, starting off with Dynamite, aka Bakudan Man, aka Nalar Ede. Not sure on the pronunciation for that last one, but it was by Bandai, and it was a juggling, catching type game in the style of a Game & Watch handheld. And then we also have Crazy Crows in a bunch of different languages, which I don't think I'm going to say. I'll try what I think is the French one, which is La Chasse à Corbeau by Bandai. It's a LCD game where you have to shoot down crows. Again, similar to Game & Watch style, and it came in two styles with slightly different sprites.
And then the next up is another one by Bandai. It's called Dr. Dental, otherwise known as Le Dentiste. And it's similar to Crazy Crows, where you're kind of shooting things, but in this case, you're shooting some sort of germs out of a dude's mouth before they rot his teeth away. Wow. Which, how do they think of these things? I don't know.
Just like the real dentist.
Yeah, but I was kind of cool to see all these Bandai Game & Watch style games, because up until now, I think we only talked about Game & Watch itself, and what was the other one?
The VTech.
Yeah, the VTech had a lot, but we haven't heard of Bandai, so it's cool to see, okay, they're, you know, in this game too, although I don't think these games are particularly interesting.
Yep, and we do have a bunch more of these Game & Watch style games that the gameplay was a little bit too similar to things that we've seen before for us to mention all of them. So I'm going to say a few, but we will have the full list up on our website for you to take a look at. We have Penguin by Epoch, Fishing by Gakken, TA by VTech, and Chickiwagi by VTech. So there's a bunch there, but again, the gameplay for most of these was similar to what we've seen on other handhelds.
And that will do it for us today. So I hope you guys enjoyed today's episode. We talked Centipede. That was a big one. I think it was Atari's second best-selling game of 82, I think I read. So that's a really big one. I did Caverns of Mars, which was a really high-selling game on the Atari 8-bit and will eventually get ported to the 2600. Wes covered Demon's Forge, which is Brian Fargo's first big game, who's going to end up founding one of the largest studios in his day and age. And then I did Tuwalla's Last Redoubt, which compared to the others now looks very small, but it was the last game of the Galactic Saga series by Broderbund, and had kind of a spy diplomacy twist to it, which was kind of enjoyable. So yeah, we are pumping along. There's a lot of great games still coming up, and today's episode is just a slice of what you guys are gonna get going forward. So I hope you enjoyed it.
Absolutely. Yeah, as Ben said, we've got tons more great titles in 1981 that we are excited to take a look at. If you want to join us on this journey, you can prep by going to our website and checking out some of the things that we've played before. We've got tons of information up there. Also, make sure to follow us on Twitter, where we post announcements. And if you have any questions, feel free to send us an email.
And with that, we'll catch you next time.
See you all next time.